This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. It's time once again to discuss this past week's important news with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
As Israel approaches its election and its prime minister is embroiled in potential corruption charges, U.S. President Donald Trump made another landmark announcement in support of Israel this week. For this story, we'll turn to Brent.
Yeah, Mr. Trump just tweeted on Thursday this. He said, quote, "After 52 years, it's time for the United States to fully recognize Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights," end quote. And so this was a really an interesting decision that he's made. It kind of came while we've been working towards this, it seems, with the U.S. administration, at least Israel has for a number of years, requesting this. And even previous administrations have said that they would like this, or they recognize Israel's need to be sovereign over the Golan Heights. Nobody had really done it. The Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, was in Israel for a couple of days, and he was in Israel during this announcement as well. You could see that it was possibly coming, but even he said that he was kind of surprised by the tweet by the president, the timing at least. It was going to happen, I guess, but Mr. Trump came through with it and said, no, the U.S. does back this after 52 years of Israel actually being there. It's time for everybody just to settle down and recognize that they're there to stay.
Is this the president trying to give Netanyahu a boost prior to the election?
I think that is definitely something that everyone's talking about, and it wouldn't be lost on the Israeli public, of course, that the American relationship with Mr. Trump in power is the strongest that it's ever been, and Israelis care about the relationship and the alliance between Israel and the United States more than any other relationship. And so as Mr. Netanyahu is seen as, you know, the best foreign leader in terms of friendship with President Trump, I think this would give him a boost, actually.
How do you view this in light of what we were talking about recently with this the imminence of the United States and the Trump administration unveiling a peace proposal after the election?
I think it has everything to do with that, just because this is seen as another thing that the president has given Israel. Even the prime minister noted that. He said that he started out with moving the embassy there. Well, he started out and then by pulling out of the Iran deal, all things that Israel needed. And now this is another win for Israel, another place in which the United States has favored Israel, another gift for Israel, you could say. And so maybe this is just piling on those gifts for Israel, and there is going to be a gift for the Palestinians, as we've talked about for some time, that is just around the corner, just after the election. And so it is interesting looking at this. I mean, this doesn't really have anything to do with the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. I mean, the Palestinians don't exist on the Golan Heights. There's Israelis and there's Druze. And the Druze, the 20,000 Druze that are living there right now, they would rather live in Israel than in Syria. So they're loyal to Israel. Many of them fight in the Israeli IDF. And so this is a separate kind of issue to a peace deal that would need to appear. The Palestinians, again, really don't care about the Golan Heights because this is territory that wouldn't come to them. This is technically would probably go back to Syria. But nevertheless, it is giving another win for Israel from the Trump administration to allow the Trump administration to ask Israel something very hard in the future in terms of peace with the Palestinians.
So that's really what the way that that you're looking at this is: the more that Trump gives to Israel, the likelier he is to have hard asks in the future. This is a situation that has essentially been what President Trump said de facto for a long time. Practically speaking, what does this do for Israel for him to announce this?
whenever you have the superpower of the world that says that you actually officially belong to a territory that nobody else says that that says that you belong to or you should be sovereign over, it's a big deal. That's one of the ways that you are considered the legal guardian of a territory is other people saying so. And so the U.S. still has...
The United States is the only international entity that recognizes this.
Yeah, but that's how it starts often. And that's how the State of Israel had started declaration back in 1948. Just a few countries that come along, they follow the big players' lead. Of course, Europe doesn't want to follow along, but they'll get over it. Russia said that they're upset by this. But nobody thought that Assad would get back or that Syria would get back the Golan Heights. There's too many strategic risks for Israel. This is a territory that's just 16 miles across and separates basically Iranian proxies right now on the western flank of Syria on the Golan Heights. They're on the other side of this border from Israel. And pre-1967, before Israel controlled this territory, it was used by the Syrians were there with their artillery and snipers overlooking the Sea of Galilee and firing on Jewish communities. And so no way would Israel ever give up this territory unless it was like completely a demilitarized zone. But that was probably prior to the Syrian civil war, when you didn't have Shiite militias, major terrorist groups sitting on on the Syrian side of the Golan border. Yes, Israeli prime ministers have offered up the Golan Heights in previous decades, but that was all far before the status quo that we have right now, where Syria is basically a breeding ground for terrorists that hate Israel and for Iranian proxies right now. And so Israel was never going to give up this land, but it's a big win diplomatically to have the United States say, you deserve to stay there. I mean, everyone will be upset by it, but they'll get over it. And so Israel is very happy with the president.
Well, you could see Benjamin Netanyahu and many Israelis celebrating at that announcement. And it is remarkable to see just how much President Trump has been willing to take these kinds of political risks for Israel. He doesn't seem to be averse to stepping out and doing what he feels needs to be done under these circumstances. But just to return to that, what seems to be, if I'm understanding right, your main takeaway from this is you could see as close as President Trump has aligned himself with Benjamin Netanyahu and with Israel, that this may well be, and I guess we'll find out within a matter of weeks, a precursor to the United States coming down with some pretty hard requests of Israel.
Yeah, for sure. Really, this is something that the Prime Minister himself asked Mr. Trump 2 years ago. Please allow us to say that we're sovereign over the Golan Heights. And so he is giving a personal favor to Mr. Netanyahu over this. And so he is going to expect something in return. Of course, the Bible does speak about a close relationship between the United States and biblical Judah, which is Israel in the end time. But then at some point, there is going to be a break, a severing of ties between the nations, these two big nations. And this is just another one of those prophecies where, and this is based on a prophecy on the book of Zechariah in the 11th chapter, it talks about a brotherhood being broken. It is another one of those prophecies where our listeners are receiving something from us that they're not going to get anywhere else. Nobody right now is talking about a coming divide between the United States and Israel, or if there are, that's very few in the minority. And yet this is what the Bible says is going to happen within this administration. And so, yes, this is a victory for Israel right now, but the president is going to ask something serious in return that, again, Israelis might not be willing to give up. And, of course, that issue will be Jerusalem.
You're writing an article about this?
I will be. I haven't finished it yet, so it's probably going to be up on Monday or Tuesday, I'd say.
The Golan Heights as Israeli territory for the first time in half a century. We appreciate that very much, Brent. We're only a week away from when Britain was meant to officially separate from the European Union. Well, now it's pretty well official. This can has been kicked down the road for a short ways, at least. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, yesterday evening was a time of humiliation for Theresa May and for Britain as a whole. I think everyone is aware that the government's handling of Brexit has been an absolute disaster. And what happened yesterday is Britain's got to this point now where we were meant to be leaving on March 29th, just a week away. Ms. May's deal had been voted down twice. She's been blocked or at least delayed from holding a third vote on that ill-fated deal. Nobody really knew what was going to happen. So off she went to Brussels to try and ask for an extension. She wanted to get an extension from Brussels until June 30th for Britain to figure out what it's going to do. She wanted to try and pass her deal one more time and then finally leave the EU on June 30th. And she went, she arrived in Brussels, and the other EU leaders told her no. And they basically dictated terms to Theresa May. They said, this is what you're going to do. You're going to go back, you're going to ask them, you're going to try and hold another vote on your deal. If it succeeds and it votes yes, well, then you're going to leave the European Union on May 22nd. And if it's a no, well, then we'll delay the deal just a little bit, just until April 12th. And then you've got until April 12th to come back to us with another plan and say, this is how I want to move forwards. And you can ask us for another extension then. But that's the deadline if you don't get your deal passed, April 12th. And you know, they booted her out the room to make this decision. They were all eating their three-course dinner. I think she got takeout pizza instead. Mm. They did offer to send her some food on a tray. But you just had this image of Britain making a complete mess of things, going to the EU cap in hand, and the EU, you know, dictating terms.
The European Union is in the driver's seat here. At the same time, there are European leaders who they don't necessarily want Britain to leave without a deal. There's a certain amount of self-preservation on Europe's part.
There is, or at least I think it's they don't want to be seen to be at blame if Europe leaves without a deal. There's already been actually very senior German, even Sigmar Gabriel, a former German vice chancellor, and other senior figures in Germany saying, hey, Europe, we're being too hard on Britain here. We need to keep them on side because we sell so many cars to Britain that if they go out and they end up putting trade barriers on us, we're going to be in trouble. So I think European leaders take the view, well, if they do leave, let's at least make sure it doesn't look like our fault so that where our voters blame them and not us.
Right. You know, one prophecy that we look at quite a lot is in Hosea 5 and verse 13, and it talks about the sickness in Britain. It's in the context as well of Judah's wound. But it says there that that Ephraim goes to the Assyrian. It talks about how there's this, and of course, you put that in the context of other prophecies that talk about Germany being lovers to Israel, to Ephraim or Britain. And this, the relationship between these two is very fraught. It's very complicated, but you can definitely see in those prophecies evidence of Britain being the weaker member and having a certain amount of where it is beholden to Germany, and Germany is dictating terms. You can't help but kind of think of those prophecies in light of this dynamic that has developed after Brexit.
No, I think those are really fascinating. Actually, I have in front of me, there's an article just published on The Spectator this morning. The title is "Not Even God Knows What Happens to Brexit Now." that's the level of uncertainty that's out there in Britain. But then, I mean, we know God does know. And there are these prophecies that, you know, maybe it doesn't reveal exactly the specifics of how it's going to play out week by week, month by month. But they're spot on when they're describing those general trends, like that relationship with Germany or some of those other ones. Like we talked last week about Isaiah 59 and just this prophecy about Britain's leaders being completely lost. Isaiah 3 about the leaders just being like children and all of the great leaders taken away. You know, he does give us an out. He really does paint the spirit of exactly what we see in Britain right now.
The other thing that strikes me is just the division that you see between the British leaders and the British people, where there's obviously a significant amount of the British populace that is unhappy with the British relationship with Europe, but there seems to be a much more faith on the part of British leaders in Europe and a desire to remain in contact with Europe and to maintain this relationship as much as possible. That's creating this division within the country between the leaders and the people. But it seems like that what you see in, say, Hosea 5 and verse 13 seems more reflective of the leadership's approach, where they actually think, well, the solution to this is for us to actually try to make a deal with the Germans.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And we talked about some of this on last week's show. But what I think is interesting, you look at, there are people talking about now how big of a historic crisis and a historic division there is between basically the people. It's not and the elites, and it's not just politicians. It's the BBC, it's the Church of England, it's the Confederation of British Industry. Just about all of the elites across all of these different areas are all pro-EU. Of course, all of the charities and public sector, they all get tons of money from Europe anyway. So of course they're pro-EU. But you've got this really historic difference. I mean, it's easy to use the word historic and talk about this being a big deal, but you can look at now, in my trumpet brief this week, I was quoting historian David Starkey, and he was talking about just how much of a momentous event he sees this as. We quoted Melanie Phillips last week talking about her kind of perspective on this being a momentous event. You've got the government itself saying we're in a constitutional crisis right now. So it really is a big moment for Britain. David Starkey, he wrote, "Don't be deceived by the lack of violence or the comparative good manners of those now seizing control. Mm-hmm. This is a coup, and what is at stake is the nature and legitimacy of Parliament itself. Ruled by comfortable, smug elites, Parliament is choosing to ignore the ordinary British people as they attempt to hold power to account. It is no exaggeration to say that British democracy, which stands in direct line with Magna Carta, is now unraveling before us." And he concluded that article by asking, where will it end? In another very British revolution or something nastier? I don't want to prophesy, good historian that I am, but I fear for the worst. So really something historic going on with this relationship with Europe right now.
Well, we will continue to watch, and for more of the prophetic context of what's happening here, please do go back and read not only Richard's trumpet brief from this week, but also his article in the last print edition of The Trumpet, Why Brexit is Breaking Britain. You can find that on thetrumpet.com, and we'll put links to both of those articles in the show notes for today's Trumpet Hour. We appreciate that very much, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. To Asia now, Russia is making some bold moves in Crimea in response to actions by the United States and NATO that ramp up tension in that region. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Russia announced on Monday that their military has decided to send some squadrons of nuclear-capable bombers to the Crimean Peninsula. Viktor Bondarev is the leader of the Upper House of Parliament's Defense Committee, and he made this announcement, and he said, as you mentioned there, that this is in response to the United States putting parts of its missile defense system in Romania. But these bombers are the Tupolev Tu-22M3 strategic supersonic bombers, and they are designed to carry nuclear weapons, though it's unclear right now whether these particular ones in Crimea will be armed with nuclear weapons or not. But it was just 5 years ago this month that Russia annexed Crimea from Ukraine and made it a part of the Russian Federation. And now Russia is putting some of its, you know, some of its most advanced, some of its most threatening and capable weaponry right there on the peninsula. So it's a big development.
We talk so much about just how nervous these types of moves by Russia make Europe and Eastern Europe in particular. This definitely seems like it has the potential to really put a lot of people on edge.
Yes, I think that's really the most significant aspect of this specific move with these bombers and just Russia's increasing military, you know, direction, I guess you'd say, in Crimea and in Ukraine. On Monday, actually, NATO released a statement about the deployment of these bombers. NATO is made up mostly of European countries, and the statement said, quote, "We condemn Russia's ongoing and wide-ranging military buildup in Crimea, and we are concerned by Russia's efforts and stated plans for further military buildup in the Black Sea region," end quote. So, you know, NATO and Europe are very concerned by what they see happening there, and that's especially true, as you said, for the nations in Eastern Europe that are very close to Russia. Many of them even were under the Soviet hammer. They were forged into the Soviet Union. They remember how much their people suffered.
Kazakhstan among them.
During that time. Kazakhstan among them. Yes, that's right. And this concern among Europeans is increasing. You can really see that in statements like that one from NATO there. And Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said that all of this concern will soon develop into something a lot more significant. It'll soon go way beyond words and statements. Back in 2014, right after Russia took over Crimea, Mr. Fleury wrote an article called "The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe." And he discussed prophecies in there recorded in the books of Daniel and Revelation, just showing that a European power of 10 main leaders would rise up in the end time. And then he wrote, quote, "The fear you see in Europe because of events in Crimea is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite in a sudden and dramatic way and in precise accordance with the Bible's description of this European empire," end quote. So in the 5 years since he wrote that, Russia has become even more aggressive. And now this week they announced these plans to have nuclear capable bombers right there in Crimea. So I just think it's easy to see how the Europeans are becoming more fearful and why, and how that fear will persuade them to kind of lay aside the differences that they have and form that biblically prophesied bloc of nations.
Well, that article by Gerald Fleury definitely, this is, I'm trying to remember when he began to speak about Vladimir Putin and his adventurism and just how much that fulfills those prophecies of the Prince of Rosh that you read about in Ezekiel. But we have definitely seen, he started to say that the steps that Russia has taken in that time since have just really vindicated those statements that he's made about the Russian leader and the direction that he's taking his country.
Very powerfully. And actually, if you look at the timeline of what Mr. Fleury wrote, it was in mid to late 2013 that he first said Vladimir Putin is, you know, specifically this man that we're watching for from Ezekiel 38, verse 2, this prince of Russia. And then it was just a few months after that that these moves in Ukraine happened.
Right.
So it really did vindicate that.
Yeah. Well, we'll definitely put a link to that article by Gerald Fleury, "The Crimean Crisis is Reshaping Europe," in the show notes for today's program. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Religion in America faces a lot of pressures as secularism and anti-Christian sentiment increases. Is religion dying out? For the answer, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Religion in America has changed a lot since the country's founding. I think when George Washington was president, the nation was about 98% Protestant, most of that being the mainline denominations, the Baptists, the Presbyterians, the Episcopalians, the Methodists. Those four denominations I just rattled off only comprise like 10% of the religious scene now. So those are dying religions in America as increasingly the country turns to either evangelical Christianity or secularism, no religion. The rise of what they call the nuns, not like Catholic nuns, but
N-O-N-E-S.
Like N-O-N-E-S that have no religion has been the biggest trend of the past four decades. It's gone from only about 5% of Americans having no religion to now about a full quarter or almost a full quarter, like 23%. But as a couple surveys out this week point out, the recruitment these nuns are doing is mainly from those mainline Protestant denominations that I just read it off, the Baptists, the Episcopalians, their numbers have fallen down to, they've almost switched places with the nuns, to where now they only have like 10% of the population, and those with no religion have a quarter of America. The evangelical Christians have done it hasn't been a fast growing religion, but they've stayed very constant at around 23% of the U.S. population for the past four decades. And so they make the point that the religious landscape has gone from being kind of like this monolithic, one faith, mainline Protestant nation to this very polarized two faith nation, where you've got just hardline young earth creationist evangelical Christians on the one side, and then those who are like atheist or secular or don't even have a religion on the other side,
and then kind of a squishy middle.
Yeah, well, the squishy middle's been kind of has been disappearing quickly. It used to be a lot of the mainline Protestant denominations were kind of like halfway in between the evangelicals and the secularists. Now that those are going away, it's one of the reasons the culture wars are intensifying in America. Is back when the culture wars started in the 60s, most Americans were in these mainline Protestant denominations. Now it's going towards the more zealous evangelical denominations, or right, the more zealous God doesn't exist movement.
So the number of nuns in the United States, the number of secularists is growing, the number of and they're growing at the expense of those other mainline Christian groups. The number of evangelicals is staying fairly steady, but it seems like maybe there's a certain intensification of belief among that segment of society, and that's being reflected in the polarization politically within the country. But it is interesting how strong the evangelical movement within the United States is remaining in the face of and despite of the secularist trends, and that does point to something that Gerald Fleury's been talking about for a couple of years now, ever since Donald Trump came into power, the fact that he's very strongly bolstered by that segment of the American population.
Right. You know, normally President Trump wouldn't necessarily be the type of personality you'd consider to be leading like a third Great Awakening, but and largely in face of the pressures you're getting from this secular movement, the evangelicals have really rallied around President Trump and the Republican Party. I think the exit polls, the last congressional election last fall, showed that 75% of evangelical voters voted for Republican candidates. Mm-hmm. And then when you do, I got out an Excel spreadsheet and did some of the other statistics to see that it's an estimated that like 44% of Republican voters, period, are evangelical. So that's definitely the biggest. It's not the majority of Trump voters are evangelical Christian, but the biggest block of Trump voters are evangelical Christian. So that's a huge power base for him. Mm-hmm. We have an article we can put in the show notes entitled "Who is the Modern Day Jeroboam?" And it talks about in there, but there's this verse in Amos 7 where it talks about the high places of Isaac being laid desolate and the sanctuaries of Israel being relayed desolate. And then in relation to these sanctuaries of Israel, it talks about the king's chapel, King Jeroboam's chapel. And Mr. Fleury explains in both this article and his The Lion Has Roared booklet, the Amos 7 is an end time prophecy about an end time type of Jeroboam, who will have a strong religious following. In the chapter, it's called the sanctuaries of Israel, the king's chapel, but it will be an end time leader of the United States who has a powerful religious base supporting him. Mm-hmm. Something Barack Obama definitely never had. He had a powerful base supporting him, but he was the...
On the other extreme.
He had those, the nuns. The nuns loved Barack Obama. But the nuns aren't as wild about President Trump, but he's got the support of the vast majority of the nation's evangelical Christians, like like 80% of the evangelical voters and even 50% of the Catholic voters.
Yeah. Well, Stephen Fleury's been talking about several people who are discussing Donald Trump fulfilling various prophecies of the Bible, that he's a modern-day Cyrus, that he's a modern-day Jehu, and the support that he seems to have. It definitely, in spite of his personal sins and character flaws, the people who are rallying around him seem to be doing so almost like God put him into office, and we need to support him, and you don't see too much that would shake them loose from that kind of that kind of support. So it is interesting to watch this happen in light of what Gerald Fleury was saying back a couple of years ago, and linking Donald Trump to, not to Jehu or Cyrus, but to Jeroboam. Definitely something that our listeners should take a look at. Who is the modern day Jeroboam? It's also the first chapter of his book, Great Again, and you can find that on thetrumpet.com in our literature library. Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, yellow vest protests continue to roil in France. Kazakhstan's long-standing president has resigned, and Vladimir Putin might be really happy about that. And more. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
For 18 weeks now, France's streets have been filled with protests. This week, they were especially destructive, and police watched it happen. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, we had about 15,000 gather on the streets of Paris for the Yellow Vest protest over the weekend, and it was very destructive. They set some pretty big fires. You had plumes of smoke rising above the city, luxury shops attacked, cobblestones drawn up and flung at police and buildings, the tear gas. A lot of the targets were kind of symbols of luxury and wealth, so pillaging shops like Hugo Boss or Lacoste. There's a fancy restaurant called Fourquette's or something like that that was attacked. There was a bank that they burned down, and the thing with the bank was it was on the ground floor, and further up were apartment blocks where people were living, and a mother and her young child had to be rescued and were pretty close to being in serious trouble there. I think 11 people were injured in that particular fire. But one of the things that surprised me the most looking at some of the coverage from this was, okay, there was a relatively small minority causing this violence. But then the press managed to find quite a few people cheering them on. There was one guy that the AP interviewed. He was from Germany. He'd come down to show solidarity with the protesters, and he was standing outside that burnt out bank. And he said he didn't burn it, but he said he agreed with the destruction, saying, well, banks are the biggest problem in the world. There was another person they interviewed. They said, I'm glad there are the thugs, because without them, our movement wouldn't get any attention. Yep. We need the violence so that we can be heard. So we've had this protest been going on for 18 weeks. It looked like it was still going on, but maybe reducing in intensity. Then you had this big outburst over last weekend. And it's clear you're getting a growing number in Europe that are either prepared to use violence, or if they're not prepared to do it themselves, they are still quite happy to sit back and say, I'm glad there are the thugs around here. I am so angry with the way things are going. I feel like the leaders aren't listening to me. It seems to me like the only way I can get attention from this political system is if some thugs go and burn down some banks and shops. And so I'm quite happy to support them doing that. And now, ahead of next weekend's protest, it'll be interesting to see how it goes, but they're putting the army on the streets. Emmanuel Macron, he has... They're pulling. He's announced that they're pulling police officers off Operation Sentinel, which is the anti-Islamist project where they're trying to protect against radical Islam. And there'll be about 7,000 soldiers with assault rifles guarding public buildings in Paris tomorrow to try and stop there being a similar outbreak of rage and violence.
Well, as you would expect in any kind of a mob situation like this, these protesters aren't necessarily putting forward a coherent view. You're getting a lot of somewhat contradictory calls for action on this general dissatisfaction that they have with the government. It's not necessarily terribly coherent, but it does definitely put a face to this what we've been talking about for quite some time, just how much dissatisfaction there is with the political establishment within Europe and how much Europeans are demanding some kind of a change, which when you look at in light of Bible prophecy, you know that they're going to get that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's what's interesting. I mean, this is what's going on. This is the anger. This is the rage. When things aren't too bad, I mean, I don't want to minimize economic problems. A lot of Europe is having bigger economic problems than really gets talked about very much. But these are, looking at the kind of the big pieces of economic data, these are the good times. And you don't have to go back that far. You look at, say, Greece in 2008, beginning 2009, when they had their financial crisis. And it got to the point that neighboring nations were putting their armies on standby in case this unrest spilled out of hand, in case they needed to restore order or stop refugees spilling into their own border, where for a few weeks there, people genuinely believed that the existence of the Greek state was at stake. Mm-hmm. You know, now you're seeing what we are seeing in France, which it's certainly not threatening the stability of the state in quite that in that same way, but it's still a very worrying, concerning level of violence. Well, what happens when you have that economic collapse that Andrew talked about on last week's show, for example, when things start going badly? Mm-hmm. You've already got a lot of anger. You've already got a lot of people thinking, we don't like our politicians. So, yeah, Europe is really perfectly poised for a lot of those Bible prophecies to be fulfilled. Because like we talk about, you know, the Bible prophesies a revolutionary change in European leadership. We already heard about those 10 nations coming together from Jeremiah, where you're going to have 10 kings, and the Bible calls them kings. They're not 10 presidents. They're not 10 Democrats or prime ministers or first among equals in any sense. You're getting a much more authoritarian type government. How do you get a revolution? And I'm not saying it would be a violent overthrow of the way things are going, but you get a change in government when you get a lot of angry people. Mm-hmm. That's the way that this is leading in Europe. And like I said, you just get an economic crisis, something like that, and this can really intensify.
Yeah. Well, it is interesting to watch what's happening on the streets of France at the same time that Emmanuel Macron is positioning himself as the voice of the future Europe and trying to put forward this vision of where the continent should go in the future. It seems like this undercuts his position considerably in the eyes of other European leaders, I'm sure. But we will definitely keep our eyes on that, as you mentioned. We appreciate that very much, Richard. We'll put links to the article. We have an article up on the website, Yellow Vest Protests Continue as Europeans Burn for New Leadership. And also Gerald Fleury's booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, that puts all of this in prophetic context. Well, one of the world's longest reigning leaders just resigned this week, and this could end up increasing Russia's power. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this was a bombshell announcement. It took the world by surprise, or at least it took Kazakhstan by surprise. But on Tuesday, Nursultan Nazarbayev, the only leader that Kazakhstan has had since gaining its independence from the Soviet Union 3 decades ago, gave a speech to his country, and he resigned. He stepped down. So Nazarbayev first came to power back in 1989 when Kazakhstan was still part of the Soviet Union. And then after Kazakhstan's independence, he was reelected several times, running mostly against just, you know, token challengers. So these elections gave kind of an illusion of democracy. You could call it democracy with Russian or Chinese characteristics. And in most of these kinds of cases of authoritarian leaders who have clung to power decade after decade, they either die in office or you have to drag them out of the presidential palace kicking and screaming. But Nazarbayev just voluntarily resigned. He's 78 years old, but he seems to be in good health. And he said the decision was not easy, but that he wanted to help a new generation of leaders. So the upper house speaker, a man named Kasym Tokayev, will serve out the remainder of Nazarbayev's term, which ends in about a year. And then at that point, it's very likely that Nazarbayev's nephew will become Kazakhstan's leader. So it sounds like Nazarbayev is taking the etymology of the word nepotism, which comes from the Italian word for nephew, literally. And one interesting detail that happened within just a few minutes of the resignation was that the interim president suggested that Kazakhstan rename its capital city as Nur-Sultan, which is Nazarbayev's first name. So that's a, you know, parliament passed it right away. That's a huge hat tip to Nazarbayev. So we're all going to have to update our world maps now.
Okay. So how does this benefit Russia?
Well, Nazarbayev was actually a remarkably influential figure among former Soviet nations, most notably probably because of his success in shaping the Eurasian Economic Union into mostly an economic rather than a political bloc. And his rule was also marked by constantly and very skillfully, I think, balancing Kazakhstan between its historic ties to Russia, the increasing gravitational pull of China, and Western nations. So the his success in this balancing act, especially between Russia and China, was impressive because he was able to keep from really getting sucked too much into the orbit of either one. But in the last few years, Nazarbayev began taking some steps to distance Kazakhstan from Russia. He banned the Russian language in cabinet meetings and in parliamentary proceedings. He actually switched Kazakhstan from the Cyrillic alphabet to the Latin alphabet, which has been surprisingly fascinating to watch play out over the last year or two. A lot of bizarre details there. So Nazarbayev has really tried to keep Kazakhstan from being kind of a client state to Russia, the way Kyrgyzstan, for example, has been. And I think that's the reason why Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, was overjoyed by Nazarbayev's decision to resign. Putin gave a meeting in Moscow on Monday, and he really thanked Nazarbayev for all the work that Russia and Kazakhstan have done together. But it seemed like underneath all of that praise was really hope, on Putin's part, that Kazakhstan will now be in a position to be more aligned with Russia. And under Tokayev, the interim president, and under Nazarbayev's nephew, if he ends up coming into power, it's hard to know exactly what direction the country will take, but there's a good chance that whoever Nazarbayev's successors are, that they will not be as deft in that balancing act as he was with Russia and China and the United States. So if they fail to balance it as strategically as he did, that could translate into a big victory for Russia.
Well, we can definitely keep our eyes peeled about what happens here, but it does seem like just looking at it from a prophetic standpoint, Kazakhstan is definitely a nation that we would expect to go into the Russian and the Asian orbit.
Yes, that's right. That's really why the trumpet watches Russia's expansionistic activity in those former Soviet nations so closely. Putin has made clear over the years that he's determined to rebuild the power and in some cases even recreate the actual geography of the Soviet Union. You know, we talked in the first half about his annexation of Crimea, which used to be part of the Soviet Union. So annexing that was reclaiming some of that really strategically vital geography and putting it back under Russian control. A few years ago, before that, Putin invaded Georgia, of course, and he put a lot of its territory under Russia's control. We've seen similar moves in the former Soviet nation of Moldova, and then in Belarus and Kyrgyzstan. Those were both also Soviet states, and there's kind of a different approach there, more diplomatic, at least at this point, to bring them closer into Russia's orbit. But Putin's goal of rebuilding the Soviet Union really is clear. And so I think with this leadership transition now underway in Kazakhstan, we should be watching for him to look for openings and opportunities to just bring that nation closer into Russia's orbit. And Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has often drawn attention to Putin's various moves to bring those former nations closer under his control. And he's shown how they fit into Bible prophecy. He's shown how it all connects to Revelation 9:16, which talks about an end-time Asian army of 200 million soldiers. And he's talked about Ezekiel 38:2, which we discussed in the first half. That talks about Putin really being at the head of that. So Putin will be the head of this bloc, but in order to have 200 million soldiers, it obviously has to have several other Asian nations incorporated into it. And those former Soviet nations, such as Kazakhstan, are really good candidates, I think, to throw their lot in there and just to be a part of that prophesied 200 million man army.
Well, we'll put a link to Gerald Fleury's article, Russia's Return to Superpower Status, in the show notes for the program today. If you want more information about that, the prophetic significance of Russia expanding as it is, we appreciate that, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We talked in the first half of the show about Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights. Well, part of the reason why it's so important for Israel to do that is to deal with Iran's presence on the Syrian border. A development this week could actually strengthen Iran's presence there. To learn about this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Iran has had a long-term strategy to control this territory from Iran through Iraq into Syria and into southern Lebanon. There's a lot of these communities through this area that are Shiites. They belong to the same or very similar religion to that that leads the Iranian regime. And so there was a natural connection between many of the people in these nations. Well, the Syrian civil war kind of put this in jeopardy, as well as the American presence in Iraq put this goal of theirs in jeopardy. Now, this isn't something I'm making up. The Iranians regularly state that this is their desire to control this territory. They have said that they control these different, they have allies in Lebanon and in Syria and Iraq. So this is something that they want to do. Now, there has been a big roadblock, a literal roadblock, in the way of in stopping them controlling this territory, and that is the border between Syria and Iraq. And there are a couple of roadways that connect the two nations, but these have been closed ever since 2013, since the rise of the Islamic State. That was the territory that the Islamic State basically ruled over for a number of years. Now the Islamic State is gone, and these roadblocks, these roadways, these border crossings between roads from Iraq into Syria now look to be starting to be opened. Now, this is important because it means that Iran can then get an access to via land, via an actual road from Iran all the way across the Middle East to the Mediterranean Sea. And just this week, while it hasn't opened yet, this roadway that is one of the main roads connecting Iraq to Syria in Al-Qaim is just about to be opened.
Well, we just last night sent the new edition, the print edition, the May-June edition of The Trumpet off to the printer. You have an article in this issue called Iran Conquers Iraq and Now On to Jerusalem. But you talk about just how much this conquest of Iraq has been a foreign policy goal of Iran for quite some time. And we were talking about that on the program last week. Here we're already seeing the kind of strategic implications that conquest of Iraq has for Iran, don't we?
Exactly. This wasn't possible, or this type of, there was a meeting that took place in Damascus where you had the Iraqi, head of the Iraqi military, the head of the Iranian military, and the head of the Syrian military. And this is where they announced they're about to open this border. This could not have happened with all these three leaders present if Iraq wasn't already sold on its relationship with Iran. It's basically okay, it's saying now, of its entire territory being used as an area of transit for Iranian military weapons and such transported through into Syria. Iraq's happy with this right now. This is a week after this very important meeting that took place with Rouhani visiting Baghdad, the first meeting that he's had. He's, of course, the president of Iran, visiting Baghdad, saying, we're going to do all these business deals. You're out, America. We're in. And here we have the Iraqi leader that is now Iraqi military leader that is going to Damascus. And in this press conference, it's really interesting because you have these three, it's in Syria, so you expect the Syrian army general to be leading this, but it's the Iranian. The Iranian leader, Bakari is his name. He's there. He's the head of the military of Iran. He's there saying, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. And you almost forget that you're in Syria, because all of both Syria and Iraq now, they accept Iranian patronage in the terms of financial backing and Iranian leadership over their foreign policy objectives. And this roadway is further proof of Iran's solidifying control over Iraq. And that is something that, again, this article that's in the New Trumpet is about to come out that discusses that. We also wrote about this specifically in terms of, I think, in a couple of Trumpets ago, America is backing out. This America obviously is in this territory right now. And with President Trump saying that he's going to remove those forces from eastern Syria, this roadway becomes a viable option. There is another border, border crossing between Iraq and Syria towards the south. This is the Al Tanf base. America has said now that, well, we're not actually pulling out everybody. We need to operate that base because it separates Iraq and Syria. Well, just go further north a couple hundred miles and you have this extra border that's about to be opened, and the Americans don't look like they'll be able to stop this. And so you're going to have Iranian control over territories at this moment from across Iraq into Syria to the Eastern Mediterranean. Iran is a growing empire that believes in dominating the Middle East, as the Bible brings out, and pushing the rest of the world as well in terms of getting its way. And it is getting positioned to do that as it controls these other nations.
Well, listeners can definitely stay tuned for that article from Brent that'll be going up on the website next week in the May-June 2019 edition of The Trumpet. You know, the one last thought that I have, you'd have to think, I guess, with prophecy revealing that Syria is not going to remain in the Iranian orbit, whether European powers are watching this situation develop and asking themselves, how do we arrest this? How do we prevent this from happening if it doesn't increase their interest in trying to intervene in the Syria situation? You know, exactly how this plays out, it's uncertain. I think you make some good points about the ramifications strategically in the region of the alignment between Iran and Iraq, and just how this is benefiting Iran in ways that that we would expect for the power that is referred to in prophecy as the King of the South. And yet you could also see the possibility of this actually increasing the likelihood of conflict at some point. You know, we'll keep our eyes on it and watch in light of the prophecies that we know are relevant to that area. Thank you for that, Brent. One last brief story before we close here. This is actually a story I'd like to discuss on the program next Wednesday in greater detail, because I think it's quite fascinating. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has become maybe the most famous person in the United States Congress, in spite of the fact that she's 29 years old. She has no political experience. She's been in office for a couple of months. How did this happen? For the answer, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, it is quite shocking. I guess as of today, she's been in office 78 days and has already got to the point where 7 in 10 Americans have heard of her, which is impressive enough for someone who's only been in office 78 days. But I think the only other three people in Congress who even come close to that level of recognizability are Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, and Mitch McConnell, who are the
been around
three,
closer to 78 years.
Right. And are the three primary leaders, Mitch McConnell being the leader of the Republicans in the in the House, and then Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer being the two Democratic leaders. So she's up there right with like the three leading congressional people in terms of recognizability, even though her experience, her job before this was a waitress at Flax Tacos. And so you're like, how does that and she took down the senator that was considered to be Nancy Pelosi's probable replacement. or not the senator, but the representative who is considered to be Nancy Pelosi's probable replacement, which he got in New York. But it's definitely touted as like a David and Goliath story. But as they've done more investigation over these past 78 days, he's figured that she has like some powerful backing from some powerful PACs, particularly the Justice Democrats movement, which if you go to their website are very open on the fact that we're goal is to transform the Democratic Party from the inside out, take down the moderate incumbents like Joe Crowley and replace them with young charismatic figures that will get the youth vote and don't have to know a bunch about politics because they can just read from the Justice Democrat script.
Right. So yeah, Andrea has actually posted an article about this, and again, I'd like to have a longer conversation about this next Wednesday, but he talks about this Justice Democrats organization and how they put 78 candidates to run in this last congressional election, and they won 7 seats. And you look at the list, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the other ones on that list, Ayanna Pressley, Ilhan Omar, Primala Jayapal and Rashida Tlaib, Raul Grijalva, and Ro Khanna. These are the 7 individuals that this organization has put into power, and there's a whole lot that we can learn about that organization and what their goals and ambitions are in America's Congress by looking into it more in depth. So please do stick around for and watch for that program next Wednesday, and we will talk more about that. I look forward to that very much, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com. You can find links to all the articles and the literature that we talked about on the program today. Email us your thoughts to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure.
Have a good weekend.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Edward R. Murrow. The obscure we see eventually, the completely obvious, it seems, takes longer. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.